Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens, families, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Standardized tests are an integral component of today's education. In many cases, they are the determining factor for the future. Yet, numerous problems have been associated with standardized tests. Women and minorities tend to receive significantly lower scores. Kaplan Test Prep is a premier provider of educational and career services for individuals, schools, and businesses. Established in 1938, Kaplan is the world leader in the test prep industry. Kaplan offers preparation for more than 200 standardized tests, including entrance to secondary school, college, and graduate school, as well as professional licensing exams for attorneys, physicians, and nurses. Among those tests are the SAT, the PSAT, the ACT, the GRE, the GMAT, the LSAT, the MCAT, the NCLEXRN, and bar exams. Kaplan provides private tutoring and graduate admission consulting services. Kaplan Test Prep Director of College Prep Program, Sam Pritchard, joins 411 Teen by phone. Sam, welcome to 411 Teen.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
And I appreciate it. I know you're out traveling, and I appreciate you taking the time to share with us your expertise and some knowledge about standardized testing. You know, having to pass a standardized test is nothing new, but the pressure can be overwhelming considering the significance it may have on one's future. Do you feel that standardized tests give us meaningful benchmarks for students?
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today. I think that colleges or graduate schools have a difficult task before them. They're getting tens of thousands of applications, in some cases over 100,000 applications, and they have to make sense of all of those applications and figure out which students would be a right fit for their campus community, which ones are capable academically of thriving in their communities, and having as many quantitative tools at their disposal is important and really essential to a task of that scale. And so they use GPA, they use test scores, and all the other information that students provide on their application. But GPA is the most important part, but GPAs can vary so much from school to school, from region to region, and so tests like the SAT, the ACT can provide a common benchmark where colleges or graduate schools can more readily compare students from across the country, from Florida to California to New York, and that's something that is essential for them to be able to do to form an incoming class.
So really what I hear you saying is the most thorough evaluation tool is a composite, basically. You know, the GPA is important, but the test scores can help and give us an indication of what we may anticipate. So it's not just one thing or another. Because I was going to ask you, do you think with all of this emphasis that we hear about test scores, that we're reducing people to scores? I mean, because if we're reducing people to scores, that has a big implication. Would you agree, disagree? How do you feel about that?
I agree. A student should not be reduced to a score, and a score is one component in their application, but a quantitative one, one with perhaps a greater consistency from student to student. And so I would say a student is more than a test score, but that a test can really be an opportunity. Our founder, Stanley Kaplan, would tell his students that he wished that there had been an MCAT, a test that you mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. He wished that there had been an MCAT when he applied to medical school, because it would have been an opportunity for him to show his ability and show what he can do. And so he encouraged students to take that same approach, that this isn't something that's reducing them or something that's pigeonholing them, but something that's giving them an opportunity to demonstrate their abilities in math and reading and in writing to their hoped for college or graduate school.
You know, Sam, a lot of states require public schools to administer statewide achievement tests at various levels. And the findings may determine whether students proceed to the next grade level, and in the case of high school standards, whether they graduate. Yet, you know, the other side, one can attend a private school and circumvent this requirement altogether. For example, here in Florida, we have the FCAT, and the FCAT is an integral part of the state of Florida's system of school improvement accountability. Schools are graded through an A through an F on the FCAT scores and exam attendance. Schools receive increased funding here. High stakes may force the teachers or the school to desperate measures. They may teach the tests. How do you feel about this tactic? Can we really teach the test when we're talking about a standardized test? I'd just like to get your reading on that.
I think it's helpful to understand the context where a lot of that testing has come from. Mm-hmm. Many of us have heard statistics about the United States placing, you know, some number, dozens of places behind other countries in math and science, and I think those statistics are concerning. And mm-hmm. So, you know, maybe 10 years, 15, 20 years ago, educational leaders and government leaders, I think, had a recognition that students that are in school today increasingly are going to be competing in a global marketplace, to where they're not just competing for jobs with students in their same city or even their same state, but could be competing with applicants all over the world. And so I think that's really the starting point, or the motivation behind a lot of this testing. Mm-hmm. Leaders question them, saying, okay, are our students prepared to compete with students that are in Asia, with students that are in Europe, with students that are in South America? And I think that's a helpful recognition to realize what globalization means for today's students. But then it comes to the question of application, and I think there can be good applications of that insight, or poor applications mm-hmm. of that insight. And from state to state, it really varies how states have decided to implement that. And so in some places, with the counselors and administrators that I talk to, students are going through 3 weeks nonstop of testing.
Yeah.
You know, to pursue the good goal of finding out, are students prepared for the future? That's a worthy goal and a worthy question to answer. But is 3 weeks necessary? Does answering that question require making testing the only purpose of a student's junior year? I would say no. And on the other hand, there are other states that have decided to adopt the SAT or the ACT as their state test, and then in 1 3-hour period, they're having students take a test, to find out whether they've mastered the reading, they've mastered the math and the writing that they need to be college ready. I think sometimes we lose sight of the worthy intention behind some of this testing. Is testing for most people is unpleasant. It's not something that students seek out or what people want to do with their recreational time, but it can play a useful role. But if the testing administration is not done well, if it's overemphasized, if all of the other wonderful things about education, creativity, curiosity, critical thinking, if those are sidelined in order for test preparation only for state tests, then I think that's really missing the point. It's kind of the tail wagging the dog.
Mm-hmm. Now, opponents of standardized tests say we're simply measuring test-taking ability, and it doesn't really tell us anything about the student and their abilities. Would you respond to that?
I think in the current iterations of the SAT and the ACT, these are the things that they're testing are math. They're testing the ability to understand a reading passage, the ability to express ideas in writing. And so I think some people still think of past versions of these tests when they're envisioning what students are taking, where they may have been more focused on obscure skills or obscure vocabulary, but that really isn't the case today. Since 2016, when the SAT changed, it really got more focused on the kind of skills that students will need for college and for the workplace, and ACT the same way. And so, I think these are trying to test meaningful skills that are valuable for students, but and still, it shouldn't be the only only factor in a college's decision. But I think it's testing what students have achieved in those areas, which for many careers and many majors in college are essential skills to master.
Okay. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen, and this hour we are looking at standardized tests. I am very pleased to have Sam Pritchard. He is here from Kaplan Test Prep. Sam, I had to interrupt you. I didn't know if you had any more that you wanted to say.
Just that some people view being prepared as doing something artificial, but we find really in all areas of life, coming to something with a lack of preparation really can have an impact in performance. And so rather than viewing preparation as, artificially boosting scores, I would see students that are taking a test that can have an impact on their future unprepared as really artificially lowering their scores, in fact.
Well, standardized testing has been an issue for educators, for parents, even for politicians who hold testing as the ultimate answer. And I'm so glad to hear you say, again, it is a composite. There are a number of things that we have to look at in evaluating the student. Talk about Kaplan for a minute and just the services that you all offer as far as test preparation, what you have found possibly to be the most effective in test preparation when we're looking at standardized tests. And I know we're just talking about the standardized test in general at this point.
Yeah, well, we at Kaplan, we want to bring preparation to all students and make it available to as many people as possible. And we offer a wide variety of programs, from courses all the way to free events and free programs that we offer, as well as books that we publish for just about every test that's out there. And so we enjoy and take pride in partnering with students in pursuing the goals that they have for their education, for their career. I myself have been doing it for 14 years and love to see when students have gotten that score that they know is going to get them to their goals. And it's work that I'm proud to do, proud to be a part of and continue.
Well, I just thank you for sharing your expertise with us on this program just about standardized tests, because, again, it is something that parents, educators, everybody is focused on and worried about. So to have you share your knowledge is much appreciated. And in test preparation, does it matter from your experience whether one takes the online course or they go to a physical mortar place to go, what I'm trying to say, go to a physical school, a building or whatever to take the test? Do you find that you're seeing any difference in the scores when one is studying in a group or if they're online?
I think it's a great question, and we get that question frequently. You know, there are so many options. Which one should I do?
Mm-hmm.
But I would direct students or parents to a different starting point. We encourage students to start with, what is your goal? Is there a particular school that you're trying to get admitted to? And start there. Try to find out what is the score range that students at that college have. So if we're talking about undergraduate, what colleges typically release is what's called the middle 50% scores, whether it's SAT or ACT. So it's the 25th percentile up to the 75th percentile of students who actually ended up attending mm-hmm. that university. And so that is helpful data because it gives you a ballpark range of where is kind of the middle half. You know, they eliminate the top quarter, take out the lowest 25%, and those the middle 50% that's remaining. That's the data that's released, and so that can really be a good guide when even considering colleges of, you know, where's my score right now compared with the scores that students at this college have. And we would recommend to ideally aim for that, the top of that range. So if you're ahead of three quarters of the students who are attending that school, then it's a strong place to be. It's not a guarantee, and as we've said, it's one component of the application. But to strengthen the testing piece, that really is a good place to be. And so if step one is kind of setting a goal score based on information you have from the college, step two is figuring out where he or she is now. So through some practice tests, students can get a ballpark score to know where they are. And then, you know, if we're talking about the SAT, they can find out, are they 100 points, 200 points, 300 points away, or maybe they've already exceeded that score. And so that really should be the beginning of the process. After that, it's really a time question. You know, are you asking that question 1 week before the test, or are you asking it 6 months to a year ahead of the test? And, you know, what kind of time commitment is available? This shouldn't be the only thing mm-hmm. that a student is doing necessarily, but some students find during the school year, kind of running right up to test day so that everything is fresh in their mind is helpful. Mm-hmm. Other students find taking time in the summer to really understand these tests, understand the strategies, and internalize it is more helpful. And I think then, armed with that information, students can make a better decision. So I think on-site or online can work depending on the student. There are students that learn well sitting in a classroom, but we have found that our live online classes are actually more highly rated by students than the on-site ones. And some of that is that only our absolute best teachers qualify to teach those courses. And so you're getting fantastic teachers, and it's live, it's interactive. Students are answering questions on polls and answering in a chat in an environment that's comfortable with them. But we really see no difference in the score increases or the performance that students have. It's really a matter of convenience or learning styles. And it's really about starting with the goal score, starting with where you are, and then figuring out your timeline and what time is available to be devoted to getting ready for test day.
Sam, one question I have received from numerous parents is, would you compare and contrast the SAT and the ACT? How are they similar? How are they different? What do they tell us?
Yes, it's probably one of the most common questions that we get as well.
Yeah.
And I would first, just as background, make sure that parents and students realize that colleges accept either test. So that's the first misconception that sometimes is out there, is they say, well, if I'm interested in this college, then is that an SAT college or is that an ACT college? That's not the case. So they accept either one. So whichever one is better for a particular student is the one that they should choose. So the second thing I would say is the tests have become more similar. So since 2016, the SAT has become more similar to the ACT. Some of the ways the questions are structured, the math has become more similar. The way that the grammar questions are structured is more similar, but there are still distinctions. They are not identical tests.
Right.
But since they're more similar, some of the rules of thumb from a decade or two ago, I think really have become unhelpful. And I've heard all of them, and I won't identify them here while refuting them. But really, the best way to find out is to get some exposure with each test through a practice test, and see how you score. There are concordance tables. The test makers have worked together to provide tables to show this SAT score is equivalent to this ACT score. And so when students can get some practice with each one, they're able to officially compare those and see which one is a better fit for them. And we see some students do score better on the ACT, some do better on the SAT, and some it's about the same. But finding that out early is the best way to do it.
How many tries should a student engage in taking these tests? I mean, I've seen some students take it 3-4 times, take a SAT, trying to get a particular score. I mean, do you advocate that they take it until they're just exhausted? Or at what point do they need to stop?
We've similarly seen students that have decided every plan imaginable. But our advice would be to take the test, figure out on the front end which test is the better fit, whether it's SAT or ACT, and then ideally take the test twice, because there is something called super scoring, which some people are not aware of, where, say, for the SAT, if a student gets a certain SAT score, they get that back, and then maybe they take the SAT again, and the second time, math is 40 points higher, but evidence-based reading and writing is 40 points lower, and so their score is the same, but the college is going to take the best math section and the best reading section. And so by taking it twice, even though the score was the same, that super score, where colleges are taking the best section scores and recombining them, that student ends up with a higher score. And so I think there is value in whether SAT or ACT for students to take it twice. Ideally, a student may be where they want to be for admission and potentially scholarship as well. And if not, then once more, a third time may be in order if a student thinks, I think I can do better, I think I can learn a little bit more, get more familiar with these tests, practice some other strategies, and get the score I'm hoping for on a third time. So these tests are used for admission, as we know, but there also is a component of merit-based aid and scholarships. So many universities have merit-based aid that they give to students that have achieved, are among their highest achieving applicants. And in addition to GPA, test scores are one of the primary ways that that students are measured for scholarships in addition to admission.
Well, as we talk, I think about the problem that's often raised with a whole standardized curriculum. You know, some say the problem with U.S. education is the lack of a standardized curriculum. I just want to pick your brain for a minute here. Do you feel a universal curriculum is warranted?
I think that's a hard question. I do think that it is a reality that students will be competing globally against peers in other continents, even. And I think it is an important task and question and pursuit to make sure they are prepared. I think I would leave that to policymakers, but do agree that students need to be ready for college, for career, and I think there is room for some sharing of best practices at mm-hmm. minimum, where there are bright spots where things are working. The more that others can learn from those successes, the more that experimentation can happen with things that are working well and driving good student outcomes. There's value there, whether that should be state driven or federally driven. I'll leave to others.
Are we misguided though with our reliance on standardized test scores? And I say that because I think of the recent college admission scandals, and a lot of that had to do with the testing, having someone take the test for their children, having someone change the scores. And it seemed like so much was focused on test and results. So are we misguided? Do we really focus too much on testing, or do parents feel like we focus too much on testing? I just want to know how you feel about that.
Yeah, I think there definitely is a risk in overemphasizing testing mm-hmm. or underemphasizing testing. I think what sometimes isn't emphasized in discussions about this recent scandal is, one, the news is that there is prosecution happening, that there
yes.
were wrongdoers, and now that wrongdoing has been discovered. And now prosecution is happening, and so I think that can potentially give confidence that when something does go wrong, it will be corrected on the one hand. So I think that's important to see. But two, there are a lot of security measures that have been put in place that I think keeps wrongdoing, keeps cheating from being rampant. Mm-hmm. Students have to upload a photo ID now in advance mm-hmm. so that at the testing centers, the proctors are comparing who was registered with who's showing up on test day. And so the test makers have done quite a bit to preserve the integrity of those of their tests. Mm-hmm. And I think it really is still a system of integrity that, certainly there may be bad actors who try to work around the rules or try to try to cheat the system, but I think it can hopefully restore confidence that even those who try to misuse the system, distort and defraud the system, are being prosecuted and being held to account for their actions.
Do you think all this focus on standardized testing distorts the real educational priorities? Because all through this discussion and conversation with you, you've emphasized that, yes, standardized tests have their place, but it is not the determining factor, that it is a composite. But we still are focusing, and we have been, on the standardized testing. And does it distort really what education is about, what our educational priorities are?
I think when that does happen, it's really unfortunate. I think that there is testing can play an important role in measurement in many areas of life. We need to understand our performance, understand our ability, and testing is one way to accomplish that. But if it becomes the entirety of the purpose of education, then I think that's regrettable. I think things like creativity, things like curiosity, and a passion arising in a student for a particular field of study are all things that need to be a part of a student's educational journey.
You're tuned into 411 Teen. We are going to take a break, but we will continue this conversation shortly.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
Elite colleges have long been grappling with ways to diversify student population. The elimination of the standardized test requirement has become one target for experimentation. Standardized tests are popular because they can be used to enforce standards established by a governing body. Universities across the country are looking for ways to diversify their classes without considering race or ethnicity. They're looking for a way to identify resourceful students that might otherwise be overlooked. They're looking for a way to level the playing field for those who do not have the same advantages like private tutors and college classes. For decades, the SAT has been used as a way to screen potentially successful students for college entrance. Often referred to as the big test, the SAT is a real rite of passage. 44% of the kids who graduate from high school take the SAT. I think past year, we had 2.1 million students taking the SAT. Sam, is it fair to say that the SAT is a measure of accumulated advantage, which should not be used without the student's community or background? Because I think we're getting to this when we start looking at the adversity score.
Yeah, the SAT really at its core measures students' ability to demonstrate their math skills, their reading skills, and their writing skills. Mm-hmm. It is true that students of different backgrounds can score differently, but there still is value in having students from different parts of the country and from different backgrounds being measured on a common yardstick, regardless of their background. But I think there is, also a lot of value in colleges trying to understand students' backgrounds. What has a student overcome to be able to achieve a certain score, a certain grade point average, and different activities.
Well, I think also in looking at the standardized tests and the SAT, we find that that socioeconomic quotient of the student also has a big influence on how well they do. And, you know, the education of the mother has a big influence on their score. Would you agree with that or disagree with that assessment?
There have been studies that have looked at how students have scored, and there have been differences in student scores depending on their backgrounds in different ways, certainly. And I think colleges are trying to now, as they have been, try to understand that, to put those scores in context, and again see these tests as one component of an application, but also understand a student's story and journey to get to that point where they're applying to that school.
With this, what we call they're calling it the environmental context dashboard, it appears that it is incorporating demographic and census data to profile high school students. On a scale of 1 to 100. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes. This is a tool that the College Board has at first piloted with a limited number of about 50 colleges, mm-hmm. and now is rolling out more widely to try to give colleges more context and understand what might be some of the challenges that a student encountered through life that should be taken into consideration as they're being evaluated for admission.
Now, with that environmental context dashboard, as I mentioned before, it rates students on a 1 to 100, and it's relatively three categories, am I correct, that they're looking at? Neighborhood, family environment, and the high school environment. Is that correct? I mean, can you elaborate a little bit on that? Because I was thinking, like, with the neighborhood, they're looking at things like the crime rate and the poverty rate, mm-hmm. and housing, at least from my research, that's what they're doing. So I just wanted you to, if you could, elaborate a little bit more on what they're doing, just for the listening audience, so we have a feel for exactly what they are trying to do and how they're trying to do this, how they're trying to accomplish, so that they make this level playing field, make it exist for those students who may not have all the advantages. Because the key, I think, as we mentioned earlier, is just those students who are resourceful, who may have done very poorly on the test itself, on the SAT. Maybe their scores were low, but they have overcome other circumstances and situations that definitely should be considered, given the fact that they've overcome those circumstances, that indicates they are resourceful and they do have something that will aid them in being successful.
Yes, that is correct. So there are three areas that the Environmental Context Dashboard or ECD draws from. It looks at the neighborhood environment, including the crime rate in that neighborhood, the poverty rate, the housing values, and even the vacancy rate, what percentage of homes in that area are unoccupied. Next is the family environment, including the median income, whether it's a single parent home, the educational level of those parents, and whether that student is an English language learner, whether they came to the U.S. as an immigrant and are learning English as they're in school. And then lastly is the high school environment. And so, what is the curriculum rigor? What is the free lunch rate of that school, which is kind of a measure of income? And then what access to AP courses does that student have? One of the things that colleges look at is, did this student challenge himself or herself with the most difficult available classes, but in order to answer that, you have to know what was available. And so that's included as well. And so I think this does attempt to be a as comprehensive as possible, a look at some factors that could cause that students may have to overcome as they're trying to pursue higher education. And I think I think the intention is very good behind mm-hmm. it. And I'm glad that instead of just one adversity score, in reality, it really is a dashboard, an environmental context dashboard that colleges have available. We would advocate for transparency in that process. Mm-hmm. So one thing that has been emphasized is that this is something that's available to colleges, but less so or not at all to students, not to people on the high school side, their school counselors or to parents. And so we are in favor of transparency, where if to an extent someone else is through data writing a student's story and saying this is what they've overcome, that at minimum students should be able to know what that data is and what that story is that's being written about them.
And I think it's important, but also the objectivity is important there too. I just wanted to throw that in as you were mentioning go ahead.
Yeah. I think one of my hopes in this is that students won't obsess over the score and try to pinpoint exactly how to use this to their advantage necessarily, but continue to just put their best foot forward. But my hope is that this environmental context dashboard isn't a ceiling for what they can achieve if they do see data and say and understand, oh wow, if I have this measure of disadvantage, well then maybe I can't do what I've always wanted to do. I hope that doesn't happen, and that students still see that the tests can be an opportunity to show what they can do regardless of what they may have overcome, and things that can be measured in the environmental context dashboard and other things that can't be measured.
Mm-hmm. So basically what we're saying, it's a way to kind of gauge hardships that students have had to overcome. And also, and you correct me if I'm wrong now, maybe predict which students will do well in college despite a lower score. So we're kind of quantifying.
That's correct. That's correct. Yeah, I think colleges want to find, most admissions officers that I talk to, want to find those hidden gems, those students that, though they may have faced some adversity, though they may have overcome a lot, they're capable of so much more, and they're shining, and they're, really thriving to the best of their ability in maybe a difficult environment. And mm-hmm. so I think that admissions offices see themselves as wanting to offer and confer opportunity on those students. And to an extent, this can be one tool. Mm-hmm. No test, no tool is perfect.
Oh, yeah.
But it can be one more tool that can aid in their effort to find those talented students who are capable of excelling and succeeding at their institution, and identify them and bring them onto campus.
What I'm not real clear about, and maybe you can help me with this, is just how they are scored, how they receive a score. I mean, what are they looking at? What are the variables? How do they receive a score? Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the environmental context dashboard is going to be based on census data. It's going to be based on data from the educational department
mm-hmm.
and data that students provide or that schools provide to the College Board. So there's really nothing Besides that, there's nothing individual about one student other than what they would have already provided to the College Board. So all of that, you know, much of this data would be available. You know, an admissions officer that's reading an application could go to census.gov and say, okay, here's where the student lives. Let me do some research to find this out. Mm-hmm. But this tool makes it much more readily available, where for a high volume of applications, they can find much more information about a student's community, about a student's school, and about some of their family situation with, mm-hmm. with income and whatever the student has told about family situation.
Now, I know there's always a lot of opposition out there, but some of the opposition has been simply that it's not individualized, that maybe we should take more individual situations into consideration. For example, a student who may live in a higher income environment versus a student who lives in a low income environment. Their scores may be skewed, really. You say, oh, well, that person lives in a higher income environment. Their schools are better. So we aren't going to give them a low score in that area. However, maybe that higher income environment is even more stressful. It's very difficult for them to even negotiate their environment, as opposed to living in an environment that may be lower income, may be more racially sensitive, because often when one is in an environment, particularly, let's take a black student, and they live in a predominantly black environment. That black environment may be lower socioeconomic, but it may be more supportive to that student. It may be more, and that's just one of the complaints I know that had been levied against this, that we aren't taking that into consideration. And maybe that student who lives in a predominantly white environment, which raises or lowers his score, I should put it that way, lowers his score, you don't take into consideration, or one doesn't take into, I mean you, is not taken into consideration that it may be more difficult for him living in that environment. He may be the object of discrimination and catcalls, and yet he has survived that. So how do you feel about that? I mean, do you think those are significant complaints?
Well, first I would clarify, I think some people have understood that the adversity score is almost like a curve on the SAT, mm-hmm. that, like, if you had this, then your score goes down by mm-hmm. this, or if you had this, then your score goes up. But it has no bearing okay. on what the score is. The SAT score is still going to be the SAT score. It's a secondary, you know, it's an additional score that can be paired with it to provide more context. And so this idea of a boost or a block or something is really, really not the case. I think, second, I would say that it's to hear some people talk, you would think that the adversity score has become the only factor in college admissions, and that
that's not,
you know, high scores in, low scores out, and that's not the case. Again, just like testing, just like GPA, just like, you know, high school activities, it's one component and it's one tool, and some colleges that have access to it may decide that that's not something that they want to use. So it's mm-hmm. up to the individual colleges whether to incorporate those insights into their decisions. And I think last, there always have been components of the college admissions process that students can control and parts that they can't control. And I think the students that get most anxious and stressed out are the ones that, you know, wonder what are the things that are going to affect my application that I can't even control. But our advice would be to focus on what they can control. You know, if you're a junior, if you're a senior, do your best in your classes. Try to get good grades and be ready. If you're taking the SAT, taking the ACT, be ready for test day and do your best and see that as an opportunity to show what you can do. Try to research colleges and find the ones that are most likely to be a good fit. It's never just been a competition. It should be about a student finding a college that's going to help them reach their career goals. And if if students are focused on trying to show who they are, show what they can do, and how they can serve others, then there's absolutely going to be a place in a wonderful university that's a great fit
for
them.
Sam, thanks so much. I appreciate it. That's it for a 411 Teen. I thank you for listening. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. The 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Holyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Ken Smith. If you would like to participate in 411 Team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. 411 Team archives are available as streaming audio and as downloads from WFSU.org. Check us out on Facebook.